Could you start by talking a little bit about your regular job and any ways in which your daily routine and responsibilities have changed since the COVID outbreak?
So I usually work in Bullfinch Medical Group, which is an outpatient primary care clinic at Mass General. And I usually see patients in the office 6 sessions a week. And then I also precept residents, seeing patients in the office 1 session a week. And then I'm the medical director or co-medical director of the practice. And that takes up about, one other day a week. And so when things first started, I guess in mid-March, we initially were still seeing some patients in the office, but that quickly basically got shut down to having us see almost nobody because of the fear that we would bringing patients in who had COVID. So sort of evolved. First, we started seeing fewer patients, and people were still kind of anxious. And then Mass General passed a mask policy where all healthcare, everybody working in the clinic had to wear masks. And then eventually they passed a policy where everybody coming in also had to wear masks. And over the course of a couple weeks, we basically went from, seeing full schedules, which usually would be like 7 to 10 patients per half day per provider, to seeing like almost nobody. And everybody in the clinic pretty much got dispersed to go work elsewhere. So I started working in the respiratory clinic, which was a special clinic that was set up to see patients who had any respiratory symptoms, because we didn't want to bring them into our clinic. This clinic was set up to meet infection control standards. And so I started working there. We were having meetings every day over Zoom with primary care leadership for the hospital, trying to figure out how we should be responding to this pandemic and what we should be doing with the patients, what we should be doing with our employees, how we could set up our clinic best to avoid infection spreading. And so I was doing a lot of virtual meetings and then working in the respiratory clinic. And then I got redeployed to work on inpatient because I still round on my own inpatients and act as a hospitalist for them. They recruited anybody who still had those inpatient skills to go work on COVID floors. So then I worked in the hospital. First, I worked on a COVID rule-out floor, and then I worked on a COVID floor. And those you go in and you do like 4 days at a time. And then in between that, I would do my other jobs, either working in respiratory clinic or we actually very quickly, Mass General set up virtual care. So we never had done much, especially in BMG, we'd never done much virtual care, which is either over video or over the telephone doing visits with patients. But they quickly set up protocols for how to do this. And so we started doing a lot more virtual visits with patients, again, either over video or over telephone. So, and then just this coming Monday, the people who've been redeployed to inpatient are being redeployed back to their regular jobs because the numbers in the hospital are down so much. And so the regular people who work doing inpatient are going to be doing that. And so people aren't going to be doing the inpatient anymore. So I'll be doing a lot more virtual care now.
Great.
And we're moving into phase one of trying to have us start seeing patients in the clinic again. And so there's all these regulations and all this thought with infection control about how we could do that while having patients be 6 feet apart and have everybody be wearing masks and make sure we do really good screening so nobody comes into the clinic who potentially could have COVID. And then we've set up separate clinic for people to be seen who potentially do have COVID, who need to be evaluated for COVID. Those are still the respiratory clinics. And then we have another clinic set up for patients who we know they had COVID and need a follow-up visit after being hospitalized or after being home sick. And so they need to be seen in a separate clinic. So we're sort of trying to keep, you know, people with different infection risks or infection protocol histories separated. And then we're slowly trying to add back in seeing patients in person. So I think we're allowed to see about 10 to 15% of our previous volume in person starting for phase one, and just to sort of see how that goes and see how the flow of patients goes, and then keep doing most of our visits virtually.
That's amazing that you were able to restructure that quickly.
I mean, it really has. Like, it's, you know, it's not me that has done it. The hospital as a whole has really, I mean, it's amazing. You know, when you think about how long it takes us sometimes to get something done at Mass General, like put in a request for Epic, which is our computer system, to try to like make a switch in Epic for us to be able to, you know, do something slightly differently in our medical record documentation. And it could be like, oh, that'll take 6 to 12 months. And this was literally, I mean, the hospital made like 10 additional floors, regular floors, into ICUs in the matter of weeks. They restructured the entire like physical layout of the hospital. And then they restructured all of our staff. They restructured what everybody was doing. And the amazing thing is everybody totally volunteered. And, you know, when they were told, I mean, I think initially it was a lot of volunteer, and then people are sort of told, like, you're going to go here, you're going to go here. But people really just went wherever they were told to go because they knew that that was what was needed. And so you had people, I mean, we had like nurses in our practice who hadn't done inpatient nursing for 20 years, got redeployed to go work on an inpatient floor. Or we had a nurse practitioner who, you know, has been seeing patients in clinic for 20 years as an outpatient, and she went to inpatient, just regular bedside nursing. And same thing with our medical assistants. They went to work in the respiratory clinic. And, you know, the doctors have been redeployed to do all kinds of things. Yeah, and one of the hardest things, I think, was that, you know, we're used to being supported. The physicians are used to being supported by the nurses, who do a lot of our phone calls to our patients who call in just with any concerns, and also help us answer the patient gateway, which is the messages that our patients send us. The nurses often triage all of that while we're seeing patients and doing stuff. And almost all of our nurses were redeployed to inpatient, because that was one of the biggest needs, because, you know, ICU nursing is either one nurse to a patient or one nurse to two patients. And so they needed a ton of nurses. And so they literally pulled all the nurses from the outpatient world. And so in our clinics, the doctors were basically put in the position of, we've been doing so much of the nursing. So all the triage calls, all the follow-up. And so the doctors, you know, were spending a lot of our time calling patients and doing a lot of that nurse work, which, you know, I think made us all appreciate our nurses so much, because they spend so much time doing that. Yeah.
Do you feel like the precautions in the respiratory clinics and on the COVID floors were enough to keep you and the rest of the health workers safe?
Yeah. I feel like Mass General was, I don't know, it's funny because I've spoken to some friends of mine who work in New York or work at other places, and it just seemed like they describe sort of chaos and feeling like out of control. I mean, I can tell you, I worked in our clinic. I worked in the respiratory clinic. I worked actually in two different respiratory clinics. One, you know, one in the sort of right next to the emergency room, and then one on Charles River Plaza, like a block away from the hospital. And then I worked on a COVID floor. I worked on a COVID roulette floor. So I feel like I've gotten to see sort of the range of everywhere. And everywhere, we always had enough PPE. We always had so many people there to like answer questions and help. And I feel like I never felt like things were at all out of control. I never felt like overwhelmed with the amount of work that they asked us to do. They really structured it so that, you know, the teams of patients taking care of the patients in the hospital, you had fewer patients than you normally did, I think, to try to like decrease the stress level. Even if that meant having more doctors doing the work, you know, it just sort of made it so that it was a much calmer atmosphere and you felt like you had other people around to help you. And I feel like they were always very thoughtful about, you know, making sure that we were protected. And they actually, you know, they had a study, it has not been published yet. I've just heard that they did a study at Mass General on antibody levels. You know, antibody levels are still a little bit controversial. We're not sure exactly how good the testing that we have is yet, but they did an antibody level test on medical providers in the hospital who had worked on, with COVID patients for at least 4 days. And they did antibody level testing and the levels are super low. So they're actually seeing, like, you know, we sort of thought, oh, is it going to be high? Is it going to be that all these healthcare providers had, you know, asymptomatic disease? You know, we're all going to be immune. We sort of hoped that on some level, but then the study came out and like the levels are super low. So it's actually showing that we're all working so differently than, you know, every other industry. Everybody's working at home and, you know, everything's shut down. Hospitals, everybody's working in the hospital. We're all wearing masks. We're all trying to be 6 feet apart, although it's basically impossible to be 6 feet apart when you're like working inpatient together. But you're wearing your mask, you're doing the hand washing, you're doing all that stuff. And we're not seeing healthcare providers getting COVID. So it sort of shows that, you know, what they've done to prevent infection from spreading to the healthcare providers is really working. And it's sort of a model for what other industries, as things open up, can do. You know, we're in the hospital, you know, when I'm on inpatient, you know, to be honest, I'm not sitting 6 feet apart from the person next to me working on the computer, writing orders, doing notes. Like there's just, it's not set up that way. But we wipe down our workstation, we wear our masks, use CalStat all the time. We use gowns and gloves, obviously, and matte face shields and N95s when we go into COVID rooms. So, you know, they're really not seeing infection spreading to healthcare workers. So
that's really amazing. Do you have a memorable patient experience from the respiratory clinics or the COVID floors that you could share?
I mean, I feel like I have so many. I think so. From the outpatient world, I think, like in the respiratory clinic, I think one of the things that was sort of striking was how many patients would come in saying that they felt short of breath, who, you know, actually like their lungs were totally clear, their oxygenation was perfect, and they didn't have COVID, you know, most likely. But I think there was so much anxiety that it was really hard for people to differentiate shortness of breath from anxiety from true shortness of breath. And the other thing I think a lot of patients struggled with and still struggle with is people like feel short of breath when they wear a mask. And so I would have a lot of patients who, let's say they'd been home for like 4 weeks, totally practicing social distancing, super anxious about COVID, especially if they had any health risk factors, and then they'd go to the grocery store because they decided they needed to go to the grocery store, and they'd put their mask on and they'd go to the grocery store and they'd be so short of breath. And I think it was a combination of anxiety and wearing a mask, and all these patients were coming in, you know, worried that they had COVID. So I think that, you know, that was pretty striking. I think another thing about the respiratory clinic is you sometimes would have, like I had some patients that like just were fatigued. And then they would come in and their oxygenation would be low. So, you know, one thing about COVID is like some patients just don't feel the shortness of breath, and yet their oxygenation can be low. And that was something that, you know, we've worried about, that we're missing patients who need to be, you know, who maybe need to be hospitalized because their oxygen is low and they don't really feel that. So they've actually set up all these other programs of like home oxygen monitoring. And so, you know, there's a way that patients, especially if they're being discharged from the hospital, or some people who are discharged from the respiratory clinic, they'll get monitored. Their oxygenation will get monitored at home because they won't feel that their oxygen is low, which obviously can be dangerous. And then on the inpatient side, I would say I was struck by a few things. So one, we had a huge number of homeless patients that were hospitalized. So I think that, you know, people who have fewer resources are obviously were disproportionately affected by COVID. And I mean, there was another huge study that showed that a huge number of homeless patients in Boston were COVID positive and had no symptoms. And, you know, they don't practice social distancing. They probably don't wear masks. They are, you know, sort of hang out all together. And so the spread was pretty dramatic. So we had a lot of patients in the hospital who were homeless. Another group that we had a lot of was a lot of patients coming in with COVID from nursing facilities who really, I mean, it sounds horrible to say, but I feel like they were sort of neglected in the facilities they came from, because I think people were trying to go into the rooms of patients with COVID as little as possible. And some of these patients, like, don't feed themselves, and they won't drink unless somebody hands them a glass of water and holds it to their lips, because they're 90 years old and that's kind of their baseline. And so we had a ton of patients come in with like high sodium levels because they're totally dehydrated, just because, not because of COVID, just because nobody was really tending to them and nobody was really going in and giving them the usual care that they need just to, you know, stay hydrated and nourished. And then the other thing that was striking in the hospital that felt so different than when we're normally there is that there's a no visitor policy. So nobody's allowed to come into the hospital other than the patients. Except there's obviously exceptions for pediatric patients, but no one's allowed to come in. So normally when I'm in the hospital, I spend a lot of time talking to families, and there's families at the bedside, and the families are helping the patients, and, you know, and now no one's allowed to come in. And so it's almost this eerie feeling on the floor where it's just the patients in their rooms, and they're not allowed to come out from their rooms. That's another thing, like normally the patients like circulate and walk around. So the patients are in their rooms with the doors closed, and there's no family members. And it feels so different than the normal sort of, you know, collegiate sort of, you know, lots of people around when you're on the floor with the patients. And then we try to go in the rooms as little as possible, obviously, like delivering the care the patients need. So, you know, going in and like feeding them if they need to be fed, or giving them water if they need water, and bringing them food and examining them and stuff. But a lot of the time we would actually call into the room to check in on them and have them talk on the phone, so that we weren't using so much PPE going in and out of the room, you know, more times than we needed to in a day. So, trying to think if there's a specific patient that stands out. I mean, the thing that was amazing is that, you know, you hear that the elderly get sick and people with, you know, multiple risk factors, but you would just see crazy things. Like I would had like a 90-year-old woman who, you know, she was in the hospital with high sodium because nobody fed her any water. But like she had no symptoms of COVID. She had COVID. She didn't have a cough. She didn't have a fever. She was like totally 90 years old, which you would expect her to be like super sick with COVID, and she was completely fine. And then I had other patients, like, you know, a 36-year-old who had really no risk factors and was like super sick, had been in the ICU with, you know, kidney failure and everything. And of course, those are like two extremes and just two examples that, you know, statistically are both probably rare, but just shows you that it was really hard to predict who would get sick and who would, you know, have a hard time with COVID.
Right. I think you talked a lot about kind of the depersonalization of patient care. And in a lot of my interviews, people have talked about that as kind of being one of the hardest parts of working during the pandemic. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I didn't find it as bad as I expected it to be. I feel like what we thought was right. And that's again where I feel like at Mass General, like we really had enough PPE. So I never felt like, oh my gosh, like I don't have a gown to go in this room, and so I'm not going to go again. We did, so you would get one N95 per day. And so you would just reuse that mask. And your face shield, you could just wash off. So you could use that for multiple days. And then every time you went in a room, you would have new gown and gloves. And we never were made to feel like, don't use an extra gown, don't go in the room again. And I personally always felt like I was safe if I wore my PPE. So it's not like I felt like, oh my gosh, I don't want to go in again because I'm exposing myself, because I felt confident that the PPE was protecting me. So I actually felt like, yes, it's different. And no, like the patients aren't, you know, coming out into the hallway and you're not going in. But I didn't feel like people were avoiding the patients at Mass General and not going in because we had enough PPE. But I did, as I said, feel like patients came from elsewhere and you could clearly see that they weren't getting, you know, the level of care that they normally were getting elsewhere. And that had, like, you know, some pretty severe consequences. I also think, you know, like the nurses and like the social workers and the case managers, like, recognize that because there's no family members with the patients, like, you sort of have to deliver, you know, a lot of compassionate care, because these people are, like, in their rooms, they're afraid, and they have nobody visiting them, you know, because they're not allowed to have anybody visiting them. And so I feel like people sort of took that into account and tried to make sure that they were, you know, there for the patients and communicating with them. There's also, like, amazing, you know, Mass General got a huge influx of Spanish-speaking patients from Chelsea, and they had these, you know, it's always so much better to speak to patients person to person than even through, like, an interpreter or through, like, we actually had iPads with interpreters, which is good, but having somebody, like, in person is obviously better. And so they had this whole group of Spanish-speaking physicians who would basically just go in with you to the room and translate for you. So there was another person there, because we felt like a lot was being missed with the interpreters. And so they had, like, in-person Spanish speakers translating for those patients, since there was so many of them. Which was just, like, amazing to see that, you know, again, that's something that they, like, just, you know, sprung up all of a sudden and asked people to volunteer to work for, to try to take away some of that depersonalization and to try to make up for some of the language barrier.
Right.
So
that's awesome.
Yeah.
You talked about the idea that younger and more healthy people won't get COVID. Would you say that that is one of the more common misconceptions that you hear about COVID?
I mean, I think they will get COVID, but they just won't get sick with COVID, right? So, like, we think that, I mean, I think that it's probably true. So, again, we haven't had great, you know, it took a really long time. So when I worked in the respiratory clinic, like, every day I worked there, there would be, like, a different protocol for who qualified for testing. And that was all just based on, like, how much testing we could do, right? So at first it was only if you had high risk criteria and had symptoms. And then it got to be if you had high risk criteria and, like, you could even have no symptoms. And eventually, like, now anybody can get tested. Like, you know, you could go in and say, you know, I was exposed to somebody, I want to be tested, and you can get tested. And so I think that, you know, we don't know exactly the prevalence of who got COVID, but I think that there's a lot of younger people who probably did get it, who didn't have a lot of symptoms and so didn't qualify for testing. So, you know, we can all think of the rare cases. Like, I can think of the 90-year-olds who didn't get sick. I can think of the 36-year-olds who did get sick. But I think in general, it is true that, you know, people who are older, you know, obesity was actually found to be a pretty significant risk factor, immune suppression, prior lung disease. Like, I do think all these things do make it more likely that you'll get sick, but there are exceptions. And we don't totally understand, like, why certain people are more likely to get sick than other people. You know, I think there's definitely a pattern that people with, you know, medical conditions and immune suppression and older age are more likely to get sick. But then, you know, I think that's why everybody's so scared of this disease, is that, you know, you could be, like, a totally healthy person and get sick from it. So.
Right. And then I think you've talked a little bit about the strength and sense of community within the hospital and among health workers. Do you feel like that has translated to our overall society, or do you think that COVID has done more to divide us?
I think it's so hard to know. I think that everything in our country right now somehow seems politically divided. I think that that's hard. I think our president, I don't have good opinions of. And I think that he's created a lot of division over this and a lot of politicization of it. But I think that, I think we all sort of have like shared experience a little bit. And so I think that's probably like something that brings our society together on some level. I think that there's an appreciation for first responders, which again, I think sort of brings people together over a sort of a common good. I worry a little bit that people are getting tired of, the social distancing and all the rules, and that as things relax a little, there's a lot of judgment between people, like, why are you doing this? Why are you doing that? I see that even among like my kids' friends and things like that, like this one's doing that. These people are getting together. Why are they doing that? So I think that has the potential to create, a lot of finger pointing and negative energy among people. And I think, it's partly people trying to do the right thing, and it's partly people just judging others. Some people are comfortable. Like, I do think it's okay now, for example, for you to get together with like six friends outside and do something 6 feet apart. But there's lots of people who are getting together with 20 people with no masks, and right, like, so that's high risk, and we don't really want people doing that. But then there's some people who like don't want anybody to get together and be 6 feet apart. And so I think that's creating a lot of negative energy and between people. And I think that's just going to get worse as things relax and people have different levels of comfort with what is and isn't okay. I think it's going to create, a lot of sort of tension among in small communities.
Definitely. Are there any things that you feel could have been done differently, not just politically, but in society to prepare for and respond to COVID?
It's so hard. I feel like we have never had anything like this in our lifetime, right? And so, and we're in a society where we're so used to doing whatever we want, right? Like, we are not, we're, we're a totally free society. We're not used to having rules that the government tells us that, like, you can't go here and you can't do that. And so I think that this has been like a huge adjustment for us. It's easy to look back and say like, oh, we could have responded sooner. We could have done this. We could have done that. I don't know that that's very useful. I do feel like our children have been sacrificed to a huge extent in this whole thing. And I feel like in a lot of ways they're the, sort of like lowest risk population, and they've had some of the biggest sacrifices. I think distance learning is not a good thing for our kids. I think that children like require socialization. I think teenagers need to have some peer interactions and need to also have a little bit of separation from home at, during these developmental stages. And I think that it was so easy for all schools to be shut down without a thought of, is there a way we can do some of this and allow our children to have, some small semblance of normalcy? And so I hope that as things, open up a little bit, that our children are a priority because they are the lowest risk, you know, people in all of this. And I think we need to have them getting educated, getting socialized, having some sense of normalcy, and also seeing that they can interact in the world in a way that is, you know, hopefully low risk and still maintaining connections. I mean, I went for a walk in the woods near our house, and I came upon a dad with his three little girls, and the three little girls went, "Ah, a person!" It's like, oh my God, like, what are these people growing up with
right.
thinking is, you know, like a normal fear. And I feel like, you know, it's going to be hard because kids are used to kind of being all over each other. And, you know, and so, you know, how do we get it to be that they can be together in a safe way? But I think that that's going to be a huge part of the next phase. And I really hope that, you know, having our kids getting back to being together is going to be a big priority.
Right.
And I just think it's also been amazing to see like people's different levels of comfort, right? Like people who, I mean, I think it's kind of, you know, I'm used to like maybe political ideas separating people. Like if you're like a Democrat and you're there's friends of yours that are Republican, like sometimes it's hard to have those conversations and you kind of know that over time. But like people's level of comfort with how much social distancing they need to do, I feel like has not been predictable. Like I, you know, I will say things because I feel like I'm probably a little bit more liberal than other people. Like I do feel like we should wear a mask, but I do feel like socialization is important. And so I think I'm sooner to warm up to the idea of like being outside 6 feet apart and hanging out. And I feel like I tried to get my son who's 13 and I feel like has had kind of a hard time like not being with his friends for this huge amount of time. And he usually loves school and like he's really not liking school and he's usually super organized and I feel like he's totally not organized. It's almost like not having all the social cues and all the fun parts of school has totally like taken the wind out of his sails. And I've tried to reach out to some of his friends to be like, oh, could we like go for a hike or could they just come and hang out in our backyard and like talk 6 feet apart? And, you know, a bunch of them are just totally not comfortable with that. And so it's really been funny to see the, you know, different response from different people that you would maybe not expect. And some of them I understand if they, you know, live with a grandparent or, but other people I'm like, wait, but you're totally healthy. Your kids are totally healthy. Like, what are you going to hide forever?
Right.
And then even hearing people talk about like if school opens, they're like, well, I'm not going to send my kid to school. I'm like, really? Like, why? Like
yeah.
we have to be able to, you know, I'm not going to send my kid to school until there's a vaccine. Really? Like that just seems so, such an overreaction and not based on any real knowledge. And I feel like there's a lot of that. There's a lot of emotional reactions to things. And that's also emotional. Those emotional reactions create a lot of judgment towards people who maybe are behaving differently, even if they're behaving within, you know, the rules of what is expected at a given time.
Right.
So, yeah. And it's something you're not used to. Like, we're not used to policing each other, right? And
right.
it's not really our job to police each other. And yet, like, this is something that is totally about social interactions, right? And so it is sort of our shared responsibility to try to, you know, make sure people are being safe. But then again, like some people's version of safe is such an extreme and other people like have no, who are just like, whatever, I don't care, you know?
Right.
And then I think the other thing that's going to end up coming up is, you know, once we do have antibody testing, I think it's going to kind of be the haves and have nots, right? So like, if you have the antibody, like, why can't you come and hang out with somebody who doesn't? Because you can't get it. You can't give it to them. And so I feel like that's going to create a whole other level of confusion probably about, you know, what is and isn't safe and who can do what. And it may not be that people know that, right? It'll be like, you know, you wouldn't necessarily know that this group of people all already had COVID. And so it's probably okay for them to all be in the car together. Right. And so it's going to create another level of judgment that is maybe based on a lack of understanding. So,
Definitely.
Because I've already heard people doing that. I've already heard people who are like, well, my family all had COVID, and so I'm letting my daughter see her boyfriend's family because they haven't, but she can't give it to them and they can't give it to her, so it's fine. Which, on a from what we know right now, that probably is true. And so, I do think again, like having some balance is going to be important for all of everybody's mental health.
Right. Yes.
And life restarting.
Yes. Are there any lessons that you feel like you'll take away as a doctor from working during the pandemic?
I mean, I think the most amazing thing to me has been like how quickly and how, I mean, just how quickly everything can change and how if we all come together, we can like make anything happen in like such a fraction of the time that you would normally expect anything to happen. And that has just been so inspiring. I also think, medicine, I feel like when I went to medical school, medicine was so much about just like pathophysiology and disease. And just in the last 10 years, I feel like so much of what we talk about in medicine is about social determinants of health. And, that means, access to food and access to medications and poverty and, race differences. And I think that the response to this pandemic has just shown because of who has been disproportionately affected and how the healthcare system has reacted, just has shown so much how medicine and social determinants of health are so interrelated, and we can't address one without addressing the other. And you wouldn't, when I went to medical school, we didn't really talk about how that was, part of your job was to like figure out if your patient had food. I mean, of course, like you knew that on some level, but it wasn't really overtly discussed, right? Like you can't manage somebody's diabetes without understanding like what they're eating. But this has just shown to me like how interrelated all those social determinants of health are with medical care and how we can never take care of a patient without really seeing how linked they are. And then seeing that part of our responsibility as a medical response is not just about like the disease, but about all the other things. So, like Boston Hope, the hotel that they set up for patients to go to so that they wouldn't be living in close proximity with family members, after having COVID. Like we've never done stuff like that, on such a large level of really sort of looking at all those other aspects and just rolling it out so quickly. It was just, I mean, to me, it was like just inspiring to see, what could be done if you put all of our resources and all of our time, into something so quickly. As I said before, I'm used to things taking forever to, enact a change or to start up a program or to get an idea off the ground. And this was just like, in a week, new clinic built. In a couple of weeks, like place for people to go to, hotels for patients to go to so that they weren't like infecting their like family members at home. I think it was amazing to see, really.
Yeah, that's so
So it gives me
incredible.
some hope for, I feel like we're living in a country that's so divided and that it feels like nothing can get done in the government because, the Democrats and Republicans totally blocking everything that everybody's done. And then you actually see like something happen in our world and like things happen so quickly and people work together. I mean, I think that was just such a nice thing to see come out of this horrible situation.